Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument is Beeman v. Friesmeyer. Mr. Shapiro.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is David Shapiro. I represent Mr. Beeman. There is no question that Alan Beeman is innocent of the murder of Jennifer Lockmiller, and that, as the Illinois Supreme Court unanimously held, a massive Brady violation resulted in his dozen-year imprisonment. This case is about the responsibility of police officers who worked with the prosecutor to cover up evidence. The object of the conspiracy was to bury any evidence that pointed to anyone other than Alan Beeman as the killer. And there were seven key pieces of evidence from which a rational juror could infer the existence of a conspiracy.
Let me ask you this. Were Berman's criminal trial lawyers aware of the neighbor's interview with the police, where the neighbor told the police he heard noises at Jennifer's apartment between around 2 and 4 p.m.?
That information was disclosed to Mr. Beeman's trial attorney, and that is not a basis for the Brady claims in this case. What is a basis is seven key pieces of evidence. The first is that on day one of a nine-month investigation, Friesmeyer and Soup, despite a vast universe of alternative suspects, resolve that Alan Beeman is the killer. Two, they know that Gates and Murray should be suspects, and almost immediately their polygraphs vanish, last handled by Warner and Zayas. Other polygraphs, those that aren't at all helpful to Mr. Beeman, are disclosed. It is only the polygraphs that are helpful to him that are withheld. It is selective disclosure. Three, Friesmeyer tells the grand jury there is no other suspect with any conceivable motive to murder Jennifer Lockmiller. He knows that's a lie. He's the lead investigator. He knows about John Murray. He's been present at all of the investigators' meetings. He has read all of the police reports in the case. Four, Suk does one thing after another to bury the Murray evidence. Murray is on his witness list to testify in the Beeman trial. But meanwhile, Murray's being prosecuted by Suk's colleague for drugs. So Suk tells his colleague, don't make a deal with Murray because I don't want a conviction discrediting him when he testifies. But that attempt to cover up Murray's criminal history becomes difficult because the next month, Murray gets busted again, this time for being high on steroids and beating up his girlfriend. So Suk never calls Murray, because if he did so, it would be harder to cover up the criminal history. And that criminal history, and these are police reports that are signed by Friesmeyer 12 times, vanish. Five, Suk tells the jury there are no alternative suspects whatsoever. He knows that's a lie because of the John Murray evidence. And yet, based on that misrepresentation, the trial court bans any reference to any alternative suspects.
But what's Murray's motive?
Murray's motive is that he is a lover of Jennifer Lockmiller.
Former,
who's trying to rekindle the relationship. He is her drug dealer. She owes him money for drugs.
$20?
$20 is what he told the police, as Detective Daniels testified. Murray lied on numerous occasions about various other aspects, including his alibi. So there's no reason to believe, just because Murray said it was $20.
If he was trying to rekindle a relationship, how is that a motive for murder?
Well, because there were various other instances in which she had been with him, not been with him. And meanwhile, he's taking these steroids that as his...
Well, no, I understand that. Right. That's, you know, whether he was capable of this kind of violence because of the domestic violence history and the steroid abuse and so on is a separate issue. I'm looking for actual evidence that he had a motive, because the reason he was excluded is because he didn't have a motive.
Your Honor, one might say the same thing, that he had no motive to beat up his current girlfriend because he was currently with her, and yet he was doing it because he was on the steroids, and as she said...
You know, he wasn't currently with the victim here.
That's true, and nor was Alan Beeman. You know, in fact, they had
ended... But he wanted to be.
No, he did not. The relationship ended a month before the murder occurred. Jennifer Lockmiller telephoned him in an attempt to get back together with her, and he did not want to do so. And the other thing that Suk does and tells the jury is that we eliminated every other alternative suspect. And the reason that he can tell that to the jury without being disputed in any way is that the jury, based on his earlier statement to the trial court, doesn't even get to learn about the existence of John Murray. And all of this happens in an investigation in which there is an unusual degree of collaboration between the police and the prosecutors. Upwards of 50 contacts between Friesmeier and Suk before the arrest.
This is like a 10-month, 11-month investigation, something like that, before a charge is issued?
That's correct.
So that's hardly unusual.
Well, in the totality, the level of collaboration is unusual.
This is a typical murder investigation and of an atypical crime in a small town. You'd expect there to be a great deal of contact between the prosecutors and the police in this situation, especially when the investigation takes such a long time.
Suk is present in the car when Friesmeier is doing time trials. He is telling him what to put and what not to put.
There's nothing unusual about that.
Into police reports. And he's present at numerous investigative meetings, including a 4.5-hour meeting on day one of the investigation.
Right. I don't know what suggests that that's unusual for the lead prosecutor to be in communication and present with the police as they're doing at least some of their investigation, particularly when you've got a small police force like this and an unusual crime.
Friesmeier also testifies that the prosecutor has authority over the investigation. And all of this is in context with all of the other evidence that points to conspiracy. Certainly it's not the case that the collaboration standing alone is sufficient to create a genuine issue of material fact. It is in combination with all of the evidence of the defendants taking overt acts in furtherance of this conspiracy to bury any evidence of anyone other than Alan Beeman as the potential killer. And all that we're asking for on the basis of this evidence is the opportunity to go to a jury and to prove our allegations in court. And on the basis of this evidence, a juror could infer the existence of a conspiracy without straying beyond the pale of rationality.
What does conspiracy have to do with this? All of the defendants are state actors. I mean, we've said in cases like Fairley against Andrews that when all defendants are state actors, conspiracy is irrelevant.
The relevance of the conspiracy, Your Honor, is that all of the Brady evidence was the suppression of all of that evidence was a part of the conspiracy. And as this court recognized in its recent decision in Whitlock, the existence of a conspiracy between police and prosecutors to fabricate or withhold evidence is actionable. And the district court got that issue correct. Following Whitlock, it recognized that as a legal matter, the existence of such a conspiracy is possible.
Could you just explain why conspiracy matters when all the defendants are state actors?
Mm-hmm. The conspiracy helps to link each defendant to the Brady evidence.
What does that have to do with conspiracy? There's joint action, I understand, right? Conspiracy doesn't add anything, right? When you talk about conspiracy, you're talking about 42 U.S.C. in 1985, maybe 1986, and we've held that it's irrelevant when all the defendants are state actors. Those statutes matter when some of the defendants are private actors, and they're brought into federal court because they are in an agreement with state actors. By the way, is it possible even for employees of the same employer to conspire? The Supreme Court thought not in the Copperweld case. But I don't think conspiracy, as opposed to agreement or joint action, could have any bearing.
Well, first, to answer the intracorporate conspiracy doctrine question, that is not a doctrine that has been held to apply in police conspiracies involving Brady. But to get back to the basic question.
Because, as we said, it's entirely irrelevant whether there's a conspiracy.
Your Honor, if all of the suppression of each piece of evidence is attributable to all of the defendants because they're pursuing joint action, then I Then I think that is sufficient to create liability.
That is the rule of evidence, whether or not there is a conspiracy.
Then that is
that rule of evidence is based on agency, not on conspiracy.
Certainly, Your Honor, if all of the evidence is the result of joint action, and certainly it was here, the suppression of the evidence, then all of that evidence is attributable to each participant in the joint action. And as the Illinois Supreme Court held, when all of that evidence is considered in its totality, there's no question that a Brady violation indeed occurred. And all of this, of course, is against the backdrop not only of the summary judgment standard, which requires us only to show a genuine issue of material fact, but also against substantive conspiracy law, which teaches that conspiracy may be inferred on the basis of circumstantial evidence, and the same might be said of joint action. There's never a smoking gun. There's never a memorandum of understanding in a conspiracy or in a case in which there is a joint action to undertake an illegal act. And, of course, the agreement need not be expressed. It may be tacit. And the evidence that I've cited thus far is what I categorize as the seven most important pieces of evidence, but that certainly is not the extent of it. There is also the fact that Friesmeier is falsifying drive times. He's driving fast when it's helpful to the state's case, despite the fact that the speeds that he's driving at are completely unrealistic, especially given the dilapidated condition of Mr. Beeman's car. And he's driving really slow when it is helpful to the state's case to drive slow.
How is that falsification? All of that was disclosed.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct.
Nothing's being falsified.
It was disclosed in one sense, but not in another sense. It was disclosed to the point that, as the district court recognized, it does not create a freestanding Brady claim because it was disclosed in the grand jury. But as the district court also recognized, it is valid evidence of intent, and the mere fact that it came out in the grand jury, despite being concealed in police reports and at trial, does not change that fact. I see that I'm into my rebuttal time, so thank you.
Certainly, Mr. Shapiro. Mr. DeCiani.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thomas DeCiani. I represent the defendants Timothy Friesmeier, Frank Zayas, and David Warner in this lawsuit. All of these defendants were police officers for the town of Normal, Illinois, when these events took place some 20 years ago. I plan to discuss this morning why the defendants could not be held liable for a Brady claim in this case, and why the district court correctly rejected the plaintiff's claim based on whether it's based on conspiracy or what other theory they want to propose in the case. The defendants could not be legally or factually held liable for a Brady violation in this case, and in any event, based on the theories that they do propose, there is a immunity for it. Judge Easterbrook, you asked the question of what is the relevance of conspiracy. I agree with you, and we argued in our brief.
I don't think you can agree with the question.
Well,
I asked the question.
Good point. Good point. I agree that there is no relevance to conspiracy allegations in this case. What they're trying to do.
But there is relevance to joint action.
Yeah.
Well, what they're trying to do is impute.
Agency makes extra evidence admissible.
Correct. Correct. They're trying to create an agency relationship between the state's attorney, who made a conscious decision.
Mr. DeCiani, let me tell you what worries me about this case. The district court asked, with respect to each piece of evidence, is this material or is it significant all by itself? And the judge kept saying no. Do you think that's the right way to approach the question, or does one more properly ask the question whether the undisclosed evidence is material collectively?
Well, there's no question the underlying issue is the correct standard is the evidence material collectively.
Well, but then don't we have a problem? Because that's not what the district judge asked.
What the district judge did focus on was that the state's attorney had the evidence in this case that was allegedly the Brady material.
The state's attorney had some of the pieces of evidence. I take it that it's given that the state's attorney did not know about the polygraph evidence.
That's the only piece of evidence.
All right. Well, then let me give you a simple hypothetical. There are two pieces of exculpatory evidence. One of them is known to the police, but not the prosecutor. The other is known to the prosecutor. Neither one is disclosed. And a district judge then says, neither one would be material by itself, but the two of them collectively are material exculpatory evidence. What's the consequence of such a result? Is anybody liable or is nobody liable?
Well, you can't have liability in that instance because the person who made the decision not to turn over the three pieces of evidence that were in the prosecutor's file.
In my hypothetical, there are two pieces of evidence.
Okay, and the two pieces of evidence. The piece
one known to the police, one known to the prosecutor, material jointly, not material separately, and the police decide not to turn over a piece of evidence that, had the prosecutor known it, would have resulted in a disclosure under Brady.
Well, that's not the evidence in the case.
However, I know that it's not the evidence in this case. That's why I called it a hypothetical.
Right.
But I would like you to deal with it.
Well, here's the way I would deal with it. The state's attorney makes the decision on the piece that the state's attorney has. Whether or not that would have affected the state's attorney's decision had they gotten the piece that the police had is really a question of qualified immunity in this case. Because
Could you deal with my question, please?
Has anybody violated
the defendant's rights in the hypothetical I gave? And then maybe after we're done with that, we can ask questions like, is there immunity as a result of that liability?
Well, the Supreme Court held that there was a violation of the plaintiff's rights. Does that amount to liability?
The Supreme Court held in this case, I'm asking a hypothetical question to try to test the theory underlying your argument. And
if
you can't answer a hypothetical question by telling me what the Supreme Court of Illinois held in this case.
Okay. Well, the answer to the hypothetical question is that it could be a violation of the plaintiff's constitutional rights, his due process rights, if the state doesn't turn over that piece. It could be a violation of his rights if the police don't turn over that piece to the state's attorney, but that does not become an issue of liability. For criminal purposes, yes, those could be constitutional violations, and they could result in the vacation of a conviction. But the standard for liability, which is what I am addressing here, is much different. It's much different. And we submit here, Your Honor, that the state's attorney had information in its file. Now, it cannot be denied that the state's attorney did not believe that Murray was a viable suspect. The state's attorney did not believe that Murray had a motive to commit this murder. When does wanting to rekindle a relationship with a lover or continue a relationship with a lover become motive for murder? A $20 debt becomes a motive for murder between two people in which one of them is having a sexual relationship with the other. The Supreme Court concluded that there could be motive evidence, but what they're trying to argue is that this is all evidence of some grand conspiracy. And the state's attorney lied to the court by submitting that Murray did not have a motive. I submit.
So are you saying they can only prove this if there's motive evidence? You can't look at the totality of what was done here? Because I think part of their theory is this was a tunnel vision type investigation.
Well, I don't agree that it was a tunnel vision type of investigation. The investigation was massive,
But I mean tunnel in terms of focusing on.
Well, at some point in time, it did focus on Mr. Beeman. There's no question about that. But that does not create a conspiracy. The
But it's the context in which things happen when you look at the two different time trials and the way those were conducted. And the non-disclosure of the polygraph, and specifically with Murray, not just an inconclusive polygraph, but the fact that he didn't cooperate at all, and that's the whole reason the polygraph results.
Well, there was the evidence did not support that he was being deceptive in taking that polygraph and how he took that polygraph.
No, what he did was he didn't follow the instructions of the examiner, at least as I understand the record. So you can correct me if I'm wrong. So one who doesn't follow the directions is different to me than one who is trying to be deceptive, or you get a read that is inconclusive. You know, that to me makes a difference, that someone right from the beginning is not following the directions in terms of taking the test.
Well, the examiner who was deposed in the case, and he's the one who came to all of the conclusions regarding Mr. Murray, he did not conclude that that Murray was being deceptive. He concluded that Murray was unable to follow the instructions and was unable to take the exam.
True, and you don't think that's some... That shouldn't have been disclosed.
Well,
that's different from being deceptive.
Well, our position with the polygraph is qualified immunity. Our position is that none of these defendants in this case can be shown to have purposely suppressed it. That polygraph, the last we know based on the evidence, was given to Tony Daniels, and he's not a defendant in the case. Brady liability regarding police follows tort law, but the police can only be held liable for a Brady violation if they cause the prosecutor not to make the Brady violation by not turning over the evidence. In this case, there's no evidence of any intentional withholding of that polygraph by any of the defendants in this case. The last evidence is that it got to Tony Daniels. Even Daniels says, I don't believe that it was purposely suppressed. However, even aside from that, regarding the polygraph, our position is that there was qualified immunity for anything relating to whether that polygraph could be Brady material. The only case that's ever talked about, and that's at all authoritative, about a polygraph examination being Brady material, after that was Woods versus Bartholomew, and there were a few cases that came after that. But before that, there was never a case that talked about Brady being, that a polygraph could be Brady material. The Woods case came out of the Washington State court system and went up and down, and at various times the decisions were that the polygraph could not be Brady material. And when the Supreme Court came out in 1995 with that decision, they said that a polygraph could only be Brady material if it's could be helpful to the defense, because polygraphs generally are not admissible. So as 1993, 1994...
But as I understand Illinois law, polygraphs showing somebody else's guilt are admissible.
Well, there wasn't any case to say that at the time that this was going on. There was the Picaro case and a few other cases, Jefferson case, that came out, but those cases came out later. And then the Illinois Supreme Court, that was in 2008, decided that a polygraph in certain circumstances could be Brady material. But when we're at the time of this case, at 93, 94, at the time of this prosecution, there was no case that ever said that a polygraph could be Brady material. So it's our position that the defendants, now first of all, it's our position that the defendants did not, there's no evidence to show that they intentionally suppressed this polygraph. It appears that this polygraph was inadvertently not produced to the prosecution. And that's because Murray was never seriously taken by any of the defendants or the prosecution as a serious suspect in this case. They didn't think he had a motive. It's a disservice that the plaintiffs are talking about all this evidence being suppressed and hidden. There were two statements given to Beeman's defense team that Murray gave, two extensive statements, transcripts, in which Murray talked about where he was, what he did when he last saw Lockmiller, There were some inconsistencies in there. Was there a hole in his alibi? There's arguably could have been. That was all given to them. They could have raised all of that if they wanted to. They didn't consider Murray to be a viable suspect because they didn't believe he had a motive. They relied on alibi. And Supreme Court, looking back on it, said, well, it's a possibility that Murray could be seen to have had a motive. But I don't think you can say that, you can fairly say that Suk lied to the court when he argued that there was nobody who had a true, who was truly a suspect, who had a viable motive.
Well, his statement was pretty broad. He said the defense had no evidence of anything that relates to someone else having committed this murder.
Well, they argued about Murray during those hearings, and Judge Suk argued his position. He argued his position that there was, when they argued those motions, the defense had those statements about Murray, Beeman's lawyers did. And they were extensive.
And they knew about the polygraph.
Well, they did. Well, they could have known about the polygraph. We say the polygraph information was all over the place about Murray. It was in the newspaper. They contend that they didn't know about the polygraph.
So it didn't matter that the state's attorney didn't turn it over. As long as you can get it from the newspaper, that's enough.
We made that argument. We still believe it's a good argument. There was a lot of evidence out there that Murray he gave an interview to the newspapers in which he said he took a polygraph. Daniels testified in the post-conviction hearing that it was all over Illinois Wesleyan University that Murray had taken a polygraph, and that's where Beeman went to school. I doubt the argument that they didn't know that Murray took a polygraph, and it's even in his statement when he says he's going to take a polygraph. I don't think you can say as evidence of some grand conspiracy that Suk lied about Murray not being a viable suspect. That was a reasonable conclusion to come to at that time. I certainly do not believe that you can impute any of his decisions not to turn over that Murray material to the police. The police had nothing to do with that. What the plaintiff is actually trying to do is to impute that decision to the police, to create some new duty in which the police have some obligation to oversee the prosecution's compliance with Brady, which seems to be completely unworkable and impossible.
Thank you, Mr. DeCiani.
Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Shapiro?
Yes, Your Honor. Your Honors, Mr. DeCiani stated that the investigation focused on Mr. Beeman at some point. He was the primary suspect, the only suspect in the minds of Friesmeier and Suk on day one. And Murray had a clear motive, and it's identified on page 514 of the Illinois Supreme Court's decision, which was that at the time he was trying to rekindle his relationship with Jennifer Lockmiller, he has an encounter with her while she's in the car with her new boyfriend, Michael Swain. And that's in addition to the drug dealer evidence. Mr. DeCiani says that Murray just wasn't following the polygraph examiner's directions. He was instructed 17 or 18 times by the polygraph examiner, don't take deep breaths, just answer the questions, yes or no. And the polygraph examiner concluded that it could have been a deliberate evasion tactic. This is after Detective Daniels observes his demeanor and says, in the ordinary course, there's nothing about John Murray that would make him unable to take a polygraph examination for innocent reasons. You know, and what Murray said in the newspaper, it was that he passed the polygraph examination. So even if that were seen, there would be no reason to follow up on it. And remember that the polygraph examinations were selectively disclosed. Mr. Suk's purported open file policy gives the defense some of the polygraphs, the ones that aren't helpful, and he quite rationally concludes that this was all that there was.
What about this super duty counsel says is being created now for the police to have to monitor the state's attorney? Do you think we have to hold that in order to rule in your favor?
No, Your Honor. All that's necessary is to follow this court statement in Whitlock, which is that where the police are conspiring with the prosecutor or are in a joint action with the prosecutor to withhold exculpatory evidence, there is a duty to disclose to a competent authority. If you think the prosecutor is going to withhold it, if you know the prosecutor is going to withhold it, that does not create the duty under Whitlock or in this case.
What's the source of that duty to disclose to a competent authority?
The duty grows out of the Due Process Clause and Brady versus Maryland. The Supreme Court or this court recognizes in Steidl versus Furman a duty to disclose to a competent authority, and in Whitlock it states that in the prosecutor
to override the prosecutor.
Not to override the prosecutor. I want to be perfectly clear that there's no duty to play lawyer or second guess the prosecutor or anything like that. The duty to disclose to a competent authority who is anyone other than the prosecutor only becomes an issue where there is joint action or conspiracy to withhold evidence. The principal duty is don't conspire, don't have joint action to break the law. And only when that duty is violated is there under Whitlock a duty to disclose to a competent authority other than the prosecutor.
Counsel, Mr. DeCiani said that not until after the events of this case did the Supreme Court of Illinois first say that polygraph evidence was ever admissible for any purpose. Do you agree with that statement of timing?
I believe that that's an accurate statement, but the point that the Illinois Supreme Court made is that it would have been sufficient to convince the judge to allow other evidence in of alternative suspects. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.